back. You're at UBC and you're listening to AstroTalk with Marco and Adina Howard on CITR 101.9. Welcome, this is Marco, and you're listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9. Last week, I talked about some kind of technology spin-offs from NASA, and I was surprised at some of them. Also, I talked about, also today, I'm going to go on with that a little bit and talk about spin-offs that occur from landing on the moon. So what spin-offs occurred from landing on the moon. I'm going to talk about that. And there's a lot of interesting stuff happening in astronomy, and that is always the case. So what are we going to do today? We're going to learn more about astronomy. So I talked about Voyager last time too. Voyager were the two spacecrafts. Took off in 1977. Talked about space butterflies. It's home to hundreds of baby stars. That's interesting. But what happened with Voyager spacecraft is they were on, I believe, a five-year mission in 1977 to study the outer planets because there was a rare alignment of those outer planets. So they would be closer together. It would be easier to get, for example, go by Jupiter, get a gravity assist from Jupiter, and astronomers know what a gravity assist is. You fly your spacecraft on a predetermined path, and you slingshot past the planet. So you grab some of the planet's, I guess it's potential or gravitational energy, one of those things, and it's transferred to the spaceship, and it speeds it up. So the planets were closer together, and with the gravity assist, they were able to visit all the outer planets except Pluto, which at that time was a planet. But then what happened is that it was extended, like NASA always does. They're great. They extended the mission and extended. And then the Voyagers are still going. So one of them, I believe, reached interstellar space about 5 years ago or 6 years ago or 7 years ago. And one did recently within the last year. So I talked a little bit about that. So Voyagers were always one of my favorite things to talk about. Okay, so I wanted to talk about counting the many ways the space station benefits humankind. Oh, so I made a mistake. At the beginning, I said it's the moon. It's the space station. So how does the space station benefit humankind? And I'm looking on. Good, okay. I thought my mic wasn't showing up, but the little lines are going back and forth, so yes. I hope people are hearing me. So counting the ways the space station benefits humankind. So I've done a couple of topics on spin-offs from NASA, like, for example, the rocket ship technology and, let's say, the stuff that coats the space shuttles. I believe they invented Teflon from that for cooking. So there's lots of spin-offs. So this is dated April 3rd, 2019, and it says it's under the Space Station Research, and that one of the big titles is International Space Station Benefits for Humanity, 3rd Edition. And this article is Counting the Many Ways the Space Station Benefits Humankind, April 3rd to, as I said, it's on NASA It's on www.nasa.gov, April 3rd. Here goes. The third edition of NASA's International Space Station Benefits for Humanity book is now available. The new edition fills more than 200 pages with many benefits of conducting research on the orbiting microgravity laboratory and includes new assessments of the economic value as well as greater detail about the science, the scientific value of the International Space Station. The station has maintained a continuous human presence in space since November 2nd, 2000. So next year it'll be 20 years, two decades, and is the only laboratory that allows scientists to manipulate every variable, including gravity. So what I remember, there was plants and seeds. They're doing research on that, and they're saying on Earth, for example, a seed will get its cue from gravity. So gravity will give it a cue, and then the roots will grow down. But on the International Space Station, with little gravity or no gravity or microgravity, what do the plants do when they don't have the cue? So that's one of the examples of a research. In the more than 18 years of crewed operations, thousands of researchers on the ground in more thousands of researchers on the ground in more than 100 countries have conducted more than 2,500 experiments in microgravity, and that number continues to grow. This book provides examples of research accomplishments in areas of economic development of space, innovative technology, human health, Earth observations, and disaster response and global education. So says Kurt Costello, acting chief scientist for the International Space Station at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston, and quote, "This edition tells stories about the amazing accomplishments aboard the space station, which serves as a unique engine to drive scientific discovery. As interest in using the laboratory grows to increase, continues to increase, many researchers new to space have come on board, and we've added many new facilities. These all greatly increase the science we can accomplish and the rate at which that science translates to additional research and applications," end quote. I would find it interesting to know how you can get your research done on the International Space Station. For example, I guess there's a lot of people that want to get their project done, so they apply. And then they're screened, all these applications, and then finally they decide. I wonder how rigorous it is to get on there. It must be quite a bit of competition. The book is a product of the International Space Station Program Science Forum made of senior science representatives across the international partnership, which includes the Canadian Space Agency, European Space Agency, the Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency, the Russian Space Agency, Roscosmos, the Italian Space Agency, and NASA. The International Space Station, United States onboard segment, also is designated as a U.S. national laboratory whose mission is to enable scientific opportunity aboard the orbiting outpost to benefit life on Earth. Okay, so this article is supposed to tell the benefits of humanity, that all the spin-offs from the International Space Station, and it's not. It's at the bottom. So I'll just read this, and then we'll go to that part. These International Space Station partners have distinct agency goals for research, but each share the goal of working together to expand the resulting knowledge of the betterment of humanity. I would assume the Canadian Space Agency would research how to grow marijuana and microgravity. Wouldn't that be interesting? In the book, the members of the International Space Station Program Science Forum provide their unique perspectives about the benefits of research and technology development, market innovation, and the ongoing support of a sustainable space-based economy. Says Costello, and quote, "It's a very exciting time for microgravity research. Research on the space station feeds our future space exploration goals and makes our world a better place," end quote. So, for more information about the space station benefits for humanity, go to www.nasa.gov/station benefits. And let's see, I'm going to go to that right now. Hopefully we'll get... So again, this article is dated April 3rd, 2019. It's on www.nasa.gov. and it's about counting the many ways the space station benefits humankind. So now I'm going to go to one of those, and here's the benefits. Okay, so there's all these subtitles, economic valuation, scientific, let's go to innovative technology, maybe. And there's also one about human health, so maybe we can find something there. So innovative technology, more efficient, lightweight water filtration technologies in space and Earth. Advanced NASA technology supports water purification efforts worldwide. That's pretty good. There's two water projects where they're purifying water or filtrate water. Another one is space station inspired M-Water app identifies healthy water sources. Commercial applications for microbial filtration in space. Space-tested fluid flow advances infectious disease diagnosis. Improved oil exploration strategies, clothes made in space, sleepwear with a purpose, and it goes on and on. So that's some of the benefits. And then human health. Here's another page. It shows a little girl. The Adeli treatment suit is used for pediatric rehabilitation. So it looks like a little girl's in a bodysuit, and it's helping her walk, which is very nice. So this is human health. The International Space Station is a unique laboratory for performing investigations that affect human health, both in space and Earth. The space station has enabled research that is providing a better understanding of many aspects of human health, including aging, trauma, disease, and environmental impacts. Driven by the need to support astronaut health, several biological and human physiological investigations have yielded important results that can benefit us here on Earth. These results include new ways to mitigate bone loss, insights into bacterial behavior, and innovative wound healing techniques. Advances in telemedicine, disease models, psychological stress response systems, nutrition, and cell behavior are just a few more examples of the benefits that have been gained from applying studies in orbit to human health back on Earth. So I wonder how they would test that. For example, when the human cell goes through meiosis and mitosis and metaphase and anaphase and all that, how does gravity affect that and what benefits? I guess you'd have to really go deep into that and study that more I'd have to go look in and take notes. I might do it. We'll see. Okay. So the contents on human health, here's the title page, Space Station Robotic arms have a long reach. Okay, robotic arms lend a healing touch. Robots from space lead to one-stop breast cancer diagnosis treatment. That's interesting. Improved eye surgery with space hardware. The art and science of detecting chromosome damage. That's interesting. Senior technologies for high-pressure jobs and operations. Non-invasive collection of saliva helps monitor stress in real time. And this page, it's really long. So here's another one, for example. Cancer-targeted treatments from space station discovery. Getting to the bottom of humans' greatest infection, periodontal disease. So targeted treatments improve immune response. And here's another one. Experiments with higher plants on the Russian segment of the International Space Station. So there's all these, I just can't stop. Here's another one. Countering neurological maladaptation. New ways to assess neurovestibular system health in space also benefits those on Earth. So as we can see, the International Space Station, and I covered this last week. Today's topic is counting the many ways the space station benefits humankind. So it's on NASA.gov, April 3rd, 2019. There's a book. It says Benefits for Humanity. And you know what? I promise I'll read the book this week. And I'll do maybe a show on it next week. Wow, wouldn't that be interesting? So Counting the Many Ways the Space Station Benefits Humankind, April 3rd, 2019 on www.nasa.gov. So it's not just a sinkhole where money's invested in space research and it goes nowhere. There's actually benefits for it. And believe it or not, This might be a newsflash to some people, but there are people that complain, say, why not? And I can understand why they would complain. Why spend money on space when there's so much to improve on Earth? And yeah, we can invest more on Earth, but we are a space-faring race. And Stephen Hawking, I've repeated this again, he thinks, before he died, he thinks we have maybe 100 years left on Earth due to global warming or some asteroid or meteorite or whatever. And there is a certainty, and this could change, but the age of the humans will end in 500 million years. The sun is getting bigger every decade or every century. It's getting brighter by 1%. So in 500 million years, the CO2 will be pumped out of the atmosphere. Plants won't live. Animals won't live. The day of the human, the age of the human will end, believe it or not. So we are a spacefaring race. We are going to visit other, I can't say solar systems, but other planets in our solar system. And maybe one day we will be like Star Trek or Star Wars, where there's a big galaxy and there's races everywhere, and we might populate them. But there's a lot, long way to go for technology. We haven't even begun to blast off to Mars. So, but space research does benefit humankind. So what's our next topic? I'll do a little bit of the next topic, and then I will go to a break. So this is an interesting article. NASA's OCO-3 measures how plants grow and glow. So this is dated April 9th, 2019. It's on NASA.gov. And again, the title is NASA's OCO, so I believe that's oxygen, carbon, oxygen-3, measures how plants grow and glow. Maybe it might not be oxygen, carbon, oxygen. Okay, so it shows a nice, beautiful picture of a glowing plant. It's like a neon, glowing beautifully in neon. And it's got bright red and purplish color, maroon and bluish and aqua blue and green and white. So let's see what the subtitle is. This honeysuckle is glowing in response to a high energy ultraviolet light rather than to the sun. But its shine is similar to the solar induced fluorescence that OCO-3 will measure. So what's OCO-3? So again, this is on www.nasa.gov, and it is talking about NASA's OCO-3 measures how plants grow and glow. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to read a little bit about it, and then we're going to go to a break. So when plants take in too much energy, they don't get fat. They lighten up. Why couldn't we do that? They absorb more sunlight than they need to power photosynthesis, and they get rid of the excess solar energy by emitting it as a very faint glow. The light is far too dim for us to notice under normal circumstances, but it can be measured with a spectrometer. Called solar-induced fluorescence, SIF, it's the most accurate signal of photosynthesis that can be observed from space. Wow, you can observe this from space. So isn't that interesting how efficient plants are? When they take in too much energy, they glow. They're not like us humans, like me. We store fat. And the plants, they get rid of the excess solar energy by emitting it as a very faint glow. So there's an astronomer I heard last week. I was watching a show, Professor Brian Cox, and he said, if we talk about machines, we could talk about cars or a computer, or we can talk about a spacecraft or all the instruments on there, like a telescope or an infrared something or other. But he was talking about a leaf. He said it's one of the most amazing machines on Earth, in a way it is, because what it does is convert sunlight through photosynthesis. And so we're going to talk about more about these wonderful machines. This is an article, NASA's OCO-3, measures how plants grow and glow. It's on April 9, 2019. It's on www.nasa.gov. And when we come back, we will talk about this wonderful machine, the plant. So thank you for listening. This is Marco. You are listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9.
Welcome. You're listening to CITR 101.9. It's...
Say, baby. Don't get in no trouble.
No, we're just trying to win this dance.
100.
You're staying alive on 101.9 with Marco on Astro Talk.
We got the refugees, all stars, rubber dubbing in the club. Y Club, Jean.
Look at here, look at shorty got back. Should I ask her for a dance? Hold on, there's too many in the wolf pack. And besides, dirty cash talking to her, buying her fake furs and taking her to the fever.
Welcome, you're listening to CITR 101.9. It's Thursday, it's 3 o'clock, and it's time for another 1/2 hour of astronomy talk with your host Marco on CITR's Astro Talk.
Ouija's, check the spelling, R-E-F-U-G-E. E, get the CD from Sam Goody. You ain't even close with the rhymes that you wrote. Don't be mad cause you broke. Let me clear my throat.
You're listening to Astro Talk with Marco on CITR 101.9 FM.
Me, I'm eating mangoes in Trinidad with attorneys. Yeah. My crew slang flow worldwide like a current. Whip to every spot where nobody got insurance. Rubber do the math, you ain't half niggas at it. My man's claim true, you forget about it. Ho-ho, just a nuisance, like my influence. Well recognized, you a lie trying to do it. Got you told your lady, oops, we nuts, baby. Smooth and charismatic, automatic, you gon' save me. God bless the dead as my son survived. We strive to teach you, baby, and stay alive. Alive.
You know what's better than reading a great magazine? Reading a great magazine that also helps you fight poverty. Megaphone Magazine is sold by homeless and low-income vendors on the streets of Vancouver and Victoria. Vendors buy magazines for 75 cents and sell them for $2. It's flexible, low-barrier work for people who may not have access to traditional jobs. Download the Megaphone app to find vendors and buy the magazine, even when you don't have change.
UBC Africa Awareness Initiative is a student-run organization that advocates for a greater inclusion of Africa and African-related issues in UBC academia and social life. Some of our major events include Dioko, UBC's largest African dance party, Culture Night, a celebration of African culture and diversity, and Conference Week, where our goal is to foster more intelligent and intellectual dialogue about Africa on the UBC campus. With this in mind, we hope to contribute towards creating global citizens with a more informed perspective of the continent.
You've stated that you believe there could be an infinite number of parallel universes. Does that mean that there is a universe out there where I am smarter than you?
Yes, and also a universe where you're funny.
Okay, all right. Look, if you're so smart, what number am I thinking
13.
Of? 13. It was 13. I was thinking of 13. Okay, that was a lucky guess. What am I thinking right now?
That you've been a huge disappointment for your family.
I wasn't thinking that.
Welcome back. This is Marco. You're listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9. So I've had that played before, but I just wanted to play it to remember that amazing guy, Steve Hawkins, and he was a true international celebrity. I believe just like Einstein, when Einstein discovered all his wonderful theories, or made all his wonderful theories, not discovered. He didn't invent it, he just discovered it. Yeah, discovered. And he was a celebrity too, so Stephen Hawking was a celebrity. And I don't know if there's anyone there to take his place, but there was Einstein, then Hawking, who's next? Okay, so I'm talking about plants, and I guess we take things for granted here on Earth. Professor Brian Cox, he does a show on BBC Earth and talks about astronomy, but he also mixes it in with a lot of biology and just the evolution of our species and our race and plant life. So he says, he was talking about how the sun powers everything. For example, you have water in a lake and a mountain, and eventually it's got to climb up a hill, and I think that's what he said, and then rush down and go into the ocean. So what happens is the sun provides that kind of power to do that. And there was an interesting thing about water levels. There were solar events, and a scientist in the Amazon, he tracked over the past 100 years the water levels, and they coincided with increased solar activity exactly. So the more solar activity, the higher the water level went. So there's these intricate relationships with our sun and with water levels, with plants, with everything. The sun is what gives everybody life. And so he was talking about the amazing machine that's a leaf. It takes in sunlight, manufactures its chlorophyll, and then here what this article is about is from the International Space Station. Astronauts are able to see how plants glow, because when plants take in too much sunlight, the excess solar energy, they emit it as a very faint glow. And it's apparently far too dim for us to notice under normal circumstances, and it can be measured with a spectrometer. It's called solar-induced fluorescence. It's the most accurate signal of photosynthesis that can be observed from space. So I'm going to keep reading on this article. Again, it's dated April 9th, 2019, and it says NASA's OCO-3 measures how plants grow and glow. So I'm not sure what OCO-3, I would have thought it's oxygen-3. Let's see what it is. It'll give us a clue soon, hopefully. Okay, back to the article. Okay, so I just talked about solar-induced fluorescence, SIF, and it's light that plants, or excess solar energy that it absorbs. A plant that absorbs excess solar energy gets rid of it by emitting a very faint glow, and it can be noticed from space. Okay, that's important because as Earth's climate changes, growing seasons worldwide are changing in both timing and length. These changes may affect world food production and the pace of greenhouse warming. It's not possible to measure photosynthesis globally from ground level, and lab experiments can't easily replicate all the environmental factors affecting plant growth, such as water availability, wildfires, and competition from other plants, factors that also are changing with the climate. So I'm going to step in and go on a side a bit here. Professor Brian Cox also talked about the size of the human brain. So from studies of craniums, of brains of our ancient ancestors, they coincided, the increased brain capacity coincided with climate changes. So apparently Professor Brian Cox, his thesis or his explanation was that when climate changed, humankind had to adapt to the climate change. So it did this, human's brain increased at those particular times when the climate change occurred. So human brains had to get bigger because they had to figure out how they can solve these climate issues. So are our brains getting bigger now? Because there's climate change. Okay. But anyway, that's interesting what Brian Cox does. He links the evolution of our species and of plants and animals with differences in how the sun's energy. So when there was more energy, it affected things on Earth. And when there was less energy, it also affected things on Earth. So the sun goes through certain cycles. And Professor Brian Cox says the size of our brain changed during climate change. And also when there was more solar activity, there was some periods. These coincided absolutely almost spot on with rises in the Amazon River. So didn't I tell you that astronomy is amazing, because it tells you about, you can extrapolate to everything. Okay, so again, there's this photo, and it says NASA's OCO3, Watching Plants Grow and Glow. It's a video, and I can't play it because if I play it, you won't hear it. But it says OCO3 will be mounted on the International Space Station, where it will measure both atmospheric carbon and plant activity from orbit. During photosynthesis, plants absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and emit a small amount of light. Measuring the solar-induced fluorescence, or SIF, will help scientists better understand the role plants have in removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So again, if anybody's interested, this is another great article on NASA.gov. NASA's OCO-3 measures how plants grow and glow. It's an article on April 9th on www.nasa.gov. So here it is. What does OCO stand for? Here it is. The Orbiting Carbon Observatory 3, or OCO3, set to launch to the International Space Station later this month, which joined its older sibling, OCO2, in measured solar-induced fluorescence, or SIF, along with its primary target of carbon dioxide concentrations around the globe. The two satellites will be in different orbits. OCO2 circles Earth from pole to pole, where OCO3 will be mounted on the exterior of the space station, which circles between 52 degrees north and 52 degrees south latitude. The view from the space station will enable OCO3 to collect a denser data set than OCO2 does over parts of Earth where the most carbon is emitted and stored. The space station orbit will also bring the instrument over any given Earth location at a different time on each orbit, permitting the first dawn-to-dusk observations of how SIF varies over the course of a day. Let's read that again. The space station orbit will also bring the instrument over any given location at a different time on each orbit, permitting the first dawn-to-dusk observations of how SIF varies over the course of a day. So I'm going to pause here and make a comment, or maybe ask a question, is why do spacecrafts orbit over the poles? I've seen this happen on moons in the outer solar system, and Jupiter and Saturn. So what's the big deal if you orbit over the poles? Why do they do that? And why does a space station orbit between 52 degrees and 52 degrees south? So 52 degrees north and 52 degrees south latitude. So these orbits are made for a reason. They're chosen for a reason. And I'm trying to think, how could I find out? I'll get my email me at www.citr.ca if your brain is bigger than mine, which wouldn't be too great a feat, because I have a prehistoric sized brain. So if anybody I should get an email out to people. Okay, anyway, if any astronomers know why they orbit from pole to pole rather than across the equator, or as the space station does, between 52 degrees north and 52 degrees south. And I'm also wondering, for example, I believe it's called the Dawn mission in Jupiter. It goes out in a long orbit and comes back. And when it comes back, then it does its science. And I guess it could do some science when it's out there. But then it orbits very far out and comes back again. So I'm wondering why they do that. Why they just can't sit there on a space or just go around the planet closer, where they're always there, always doing science. Why must they orbit so far out? And why do they orbit over the poles? Interesting questions for people in the know. Okay, back to the article. So again, I'm just going to go to this article. It says, NASA's OCO3 measures how plants grow and glow in space. Dated April 9, 2019. And what does OCO stand for? OCO-3. The Orbiting Carbon Observatory 3, and it's going to launch to the International Space Station. And there's one orbiting over the poles. It's OCO2. It's going to measure the solar-induced fluorescence. So I never knew there was such a thing. But you know what? Astronomy is such a big field. Who can know everything? Okay, here we go. Nicholas Parazu of NASA's JPL in California is a lead scientist for OCO3, and he's looking forward to the combined data set to gain insight into remote regions that are relatively little studied. So says Nicholas Parazu, and quote, the two high carbon, highly uncertain regions on Earth are the Arctic, where there's a lot of carbon in the ground, and the tropics, where there's a lot of carbon in the plants. With OCO2 and OCO3 combined, we're going to observe those regions in unprecedented detail, unquote. So I guess I got part of my answer here. In the Arctic, there's a lot of carbon in the ground. And I remember a scary story. There's a lot of carbon in the ground, and it's covered by ice. So what happens when the ice melts? The carbon will be released into the atmosphere. And with global warming, with icebergs melting, with ice sheets melting, with glaciers melting, this stuff is going to be released into the atmosphere a lot quicker, a lot sooner than the time that scientists previously predicted. So, reasons to be scared. Okay, so Parazu and his colleagues will use previously developed algorithms to extract the SIF signal from the full set of data collected by OCO3. And again, SIF is, what is it? Here it is. I keep having to look for it. Solar induced fluorescence. So that's when plants glow, when they take in excess energy, they emit the excess energy as a fluorescent light or energy. So they are looking at this. So they're going to use algorithms to extract the SIF signal with OCO3. The instrument consists of three spectrometers, each observing different bands of wavelength in the electromagnetic spectrum. Every kind of gas molecule in the atmosphere, oxygen, carbon dioxide, and the others, absorb sunlight in a unique set of wavelengths. A spectrometer looking at the right wavelengths will see this absorption as a distinctive series of dark lines, like the spectral barcode of a particular gas. So, for example, when you go to the supermarket and there is scanned on the checkout, it scans a certain barcode. Well, that's what a spectrum looks like. So a spectrum can be an emission spectrum where electrons are emitting photons of light, and they do this when they jump from higher energies to higher energy levels, or higher orbits to lower energy levels or orbits, or sometimes you can have an absorption spectrum. So when a gas absorbs a particular, when an electron absorbs a particular wavelength and it will jump up, it gives energy, it'll jump up to a higher energy level or higher orbit. So the spectrometer can measure those wavelengths that are absorbed or which are missing. So that's called an absorption spectrum. And when electrons jump down from higher energy levels and they emit a photon of light at a certain wavelength, the spectrometer can measure that wavelength. So O3O's three spectrometers are tuned to two wavelength bands covering different parts of carbon dioxide's barcode and one band with an oxygen barcode. As it happens, the oxygen spectrometer records not only wavelengths absorbed by oxygen, but also nearby wavelengths where SIF shines particularly strong. So this is what Parazu said, in quote, so the SIF measurement wasn't by design, but an extremely fortunate bonus, end quote. So they're going to measure the wavelengths absorbed and emitted by these oxygen, carbon, and other molecules in the atmosphere that absorb sunlight in unique sets of wavelengths. So, for example, a carbon barcode would absorb peculiar or specific wavelengths of light that would be different from the wavelengths of light that oxygen absorbs. So, what happens when you look at a barcode? You can say, "Oh, that's oxygen," because you know the wavelengths that are absorbed or emitted. And when you look at the barcode of a particular, it's very unique. So carbon's barcode is very different than oxygen. So when the spectrometer shows you a barcode, you can measure it up and you can say, oh, this is oxygen, because only oxygen emits that particular barcode, and carbon emits its own particular barcode. Okay, back to the article. Since NASA scientist Joanna Joyner and colleagues produced the first spaceborne SIF measurements in 2010, before OCO2 was launched, SIF data has been generated from earlier European and Japanese satellites. However, OCO2 has a much finer scale of view or footprint than any preceding satellite, with each image covering an area of about a square mile, less than 3 square kilometers. OCO3 will add to that advantage, something OCO2 cannot do. As OCO3 orbits, it will turn its sensor quickly to point at instrumented towers on the ground below the spacecraft. These towers measure SIF and photosynthesis concurrently, with similar resolution to OCO3. Validating the data this way provides critical information on OCO3's performance and increased scientific insight into the underlying SIF mechanisms. Okay, I just want to go back for a second. I want to see why they orbit the poles. So one of the satellites, OCO2, measures over the poles. So that's where the poles, a lot of carbon dioxide is stored. And plants and animals that died, and we all die, right? But when it's colder, I guess it's easier to die. So a lot of the plants and animals that are dead and that are buried under these glaciers, under these ice sheets, that's carbon dioxide. And they're protected from going into the atmosphere from this ice sheet. So when this ice sheet melts, it will release all this excess carbon. That's going to be a real problem. And it's happening quicker than scientists thought. And in the tropics, there's a lot of the carbon in the plants. So in the pole, there's a lot of carbon in the ground, and a lot of it is still protected by ice sheets. But when the ice sheets or the ice or the glaciers or whatever it is melt, they will be released into the atmosphere, and that could be trouble. And that's happening. That's going to happen much sooner than scientists believed before. And in the tropics, there's carbon in the plants. Okay, so that's the big difference between, you know, isn't astronomy interesting, how you can take a satellite and measure these amazing things on Earth? You don't have to measure the energy from a supernova. You don't have to view a beautiful nebula. Or you don't have to say, okay, this is the asteroid belt and these asteroids could kill us. You could do great research, and this research will tell us things we can use on Earth. So they're measuring carbon dioxide with two different instruments, OCO2 and OCO3. So I'm going to tell you again what OCO means. OCO means orbiting carbon observatory. So OCO2 orbits the poles, and OCO3 will be on the space station orbiting the tropics. So again, the poles is where a lot of the carbon dioxide is stored. And it is like, for example, plants, animals die, and then the ice sheet covers them. And then these ice sheets will eventually melt, and this carbon dioxide will be released into the atmosphere. And CO2 is in the plants itself right now. So these OCO2 and OCO3 measure carbon in the ground, in the plants, in the air. And they measure carbon dioxide, they measure oxygen and other gases. So it's given scientists a much better picture of this carbon cycle and other cycles, and what's actually happening with our carbon cycles. Okay, so since NASA scientist Joanna Joyner and colleagues produced the first spaceborne SIF measurements in 2010, before OCO2 was launched, SIF data had been generated from earlier European and Japanese observations and observatories. Okay, so I'm going to go for a quick break. When we come back, we're going to finish off this interesting article. So this is Marco. You are listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9.
Wine up the ting till it pile up. Big bumper girl, just a wine and a while up. They must spoil me a stop till it pile up. My money no, so it my money
no. Dance like you mean it. Dance like you on fire and you want me to know. You move like you mean it, shawty. See the look on your face. You don't wanna fight, I wanna make love, maybe both. They got me looking at you, looking at you, watching the way you wind it and pop it. One more time, go wind and pop it, yeah, yeah. Bumper that drink got me feeling alright. Any little thing, I could watch it all night. Feel up on that bumper, girl, I just might. Feel up on that bumper, girl, I just might. Baby, push back when I jump behind it. When I jump behind it. So when I jump behind it, push back on me. So baby, push back when I jump behind it. Baby, let me know you like it. Tonight, let's give them something to see. Everybody's singing.
You're listening to Mayo on CITR 101.9 on Marco's Astrotalk. Push back.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have entered a soundstage at
CITR
studio for a visit with
the folks who are
directing the exciting young star
Dama Dora
and
guest
Vin.
The Real World. The Real World is the UBC Film Society's radio show.
We talk about events, actors, directors,
and genres.
We come up with most of the genres.
And that's what makes it so jazzy.
It's a lot of fun and games, except not that many games.
If you think you can handle all of this, tune in Fridays from 11 to 12 on CITR 101.9 FM.
Shout out to Ed Norton!
Okay, shout out to Ed Norton. I heard that name before. Okay, so welcome back. This is Marco on AstroTalk, and we're studying the OCO. Two and OCO3 experiments that are measuring the carbon dioxide, and they're measuring how plants grow and glow. So this is dated April 9, 2019. It's titled NASA's OCO3 Measures How Plants Grow and Glow. So this is on NASA.gov. And when plants absorb excess solar energy, they emit the excess as a very faint glow. Not like us. When we absorb excess energy or calories, we store it, but plants emit it as SIF, solar induced fluorescence. So what they're going to do, they're going to take all these all this data they got. So the OCO2 spacecraft or observatory or satellite or whatever it's called, it's circling the poles, and OCO3 will be on the space station. I think it's going to launch later this month, and it takes spectrographs of certain molecules or atoms in either the atmosphere and plants to give us information. And that's what scientists do. They search for information. So OCO, SIF data has been generated before by Europe and Japan. However, OCO has a much finer scale of view or footprint than any preceding satellite, with each image covering an area of about a square mile. OCO3 will add to that advantage, something OCO2 cannot do. As OCO3 orbits, it will turn its sensor quickly to point at instrumented towers on the ground below the spacecraft. These towers measure solar-induced fluorescence and photosynthesis concurrently with similar resolution to OCO3. Validating the data this way provides critical information on OCO3's performance and can increase scientific insight into the underlying solar-induced fluorescence mechanism. Data averaged over a large area suggests that there's a straightforward relationship between solar energy coming in and photosynthesis taking place. Well, that would make sense, wouldn't it? With OCO's fine-scale data, Pizarro said, and quote, we're finding that the relationship between solar-induced fluorescence absorbs solar energy and photosynthesis is more complicated than we thought. We're trying to understand that, end quote. He hopes OCO3 will be able to shed light on the causes of this complexity. So I'm trying to get this right. These spacecraft will measure solar-induced fluorescence. That's the extra energy, that or the excess energy that a plant takes in. They emit it as a very faint glow. So that's important because as Earth climate changes, growing seasons worldwide are also changing in both timing and length. These changes may affect world food production and the pace of greenhouse warming. It's not possible to measure photosynthesis globally from ground level, and lab experiments can't easily replicate all of the environmental factors affecting plant growth, such as water variability, wildfire, and competitions from other plants, factors that also are changing with the climate. So as I see it, they're going to look at how the changing, I just read it and I can't make a summary. It's going to get, they're going to study growing as Earth climate changes, growing seasons worldwide are also changing in both timing and length. These changes may affect world food production and the pace of greenhouse warming. So I guess we can summarize this by they're studying the pace of greenhouse warming and from this solar-induced fluorescence. Okay, cities are another area where the SIF measurement is of interest. They are hotter than surrounding natural regions because of their many heat sources and heat-absorbing surfaces, like pavement. Of course, comparing how the same species of plants grow and thrive both in a city and in its natural surroundings give a sort of sneak preview of how these plants will respond to a warmer climate. So I guess they're looking into the future by seeing the cities are hotter, and as the surrounding regions, like the rural areas, as global warming proceeds, goes hotter and hotter, they will mimic what's happening in a city. So they're studying plants, how plants respond to warmer climates. OCO2 collects a single narrow slice of data, cutting through a few cities on each orbit, but OCO3 will target and record solar-induced fluorescence at almost every major mid-latitude and tropical city. The measurements may prove helpful to urban planners in using their water resources wisely, as well as to biologists in understanding the effects of heat stress on plants. With so many promising avenues of study arising from solar-induced fluorescence, OCO3's plant light measurements will illuminate new findings for years to come. I haven't done an interview for a long time. I got to look into this. This is very interesting. Esprit Smith, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, 818-354-4269. I will contact them. And this is written by Carol Rasmussen, NASA's Earth Science News Team. So NASA, again, is doing stellar research, and they're looking how, I guess, ultimately, the changing carbon cycle and how this is going to affect plants as the Earth heats up. But, you know, when the climate heat up before, there was periods in our human evolution where the brain responded, so the size of humankind's brain increased. They had to have a bigger brain to think about how to battle this climate change, how it become hotter, become warmer, become drier, become wetter. It's, I guess a lot of it was warmer. So these climate change periods, human brains adapted. So hopefully we can all adapt. So thank you for listening. I think this was a very interesting show because it is about astronomy, but it's so cool because it could be applied to all other kinds of things. So thank you for listening. This was Marco. You have been listening to, or you listened to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9.